How did you conceive of this book?
Well, this had been an idea that had been gestating with me for, God, probably 2 or 3 years before I started the call for submissions. And I was in grad school at the time, and some other students were thinking about anthologies, and I knew that this was a topic I was really interested in, having lived through it myself. So I put out the call for submissions in, I think, 2011, and had to stop taking submissions at the end of 2012. I had more than I could handle at the, and I had no idea. I was such a novice at this. I didn't know how many people I could get into this, or and was getting such a quality work that I was saying yes to most things than I was saying no. So by 2014, I guess, I was looking for a publisher, and put together a flyer, went to AWP in Seattle, you know, went around to most of the university presses. I've been told by some of my mentors that this would probably be a good course curriculum book for universities. So I was shooting for university presses. University of New Mexico Press showed interest, worked with them for about 2 years. Unfortunately, that fell through, long story. But one of the outside readers for the University of New Mexico Press had been a professor in the program that I went to at PLU in Tacoma. And her and I were just talking about it, and it turns out she's published by Red Hen Press. So she was kind of my introduction. Peggy Shoemaker, who gives a lovely blurb on the back, just asked me if I'd like to try them, and I was floored, and it happened very quickly. So from, you know, it seems quickly after that, but, you know, probably a good 5 to 7 years in the making total. Right. Yeah.
There's an art to anthologies, isn't there?
Yeah.
It's almost like there's a poetics to it. Like, you know, you think of the anthology. I think of Jerome Rothenberg and all the beautiful anthology, Technicians of the Sacred and Poems for the Millennium.
Right.
And this is like the way you make a poem, you make an anthology.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought of it that way, but I think that that's true, too. There has to be a continuity. There has to be a flow. Certainly the topic has to be of interest to a certain segment of the population. And when I thought about it, I gave a great deal of thought to how I was going to order these works. And I knew that I didn't just want it to be poetry. I'm a great reader of a memoir and biographies, so I wanted flash memoir, and I wanted personal essays. So I thought about it and thought about it. And, you know, it came down to last name alphabetical, because that created a flow in and of itself. So you go from flash memoir to two or three poems to a flash memoir, and I think it flows really well.
Yeah.
And it breaks up the nationalities really well, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In your introductory essay, you talk about your own experience, and the key-dropping incident is pretty startling. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about your background and that particular incident?
Sure. My mom was born in San Salvador, the capital city of El Salvador, in 1927. She came to this country when her father suddenly died. Her mother had already been living here with several of my great aunts, my grandmother's siblings. So she came to the U.S., to San Francisco, on a United Fruit banana boat, because her father had been an importer with the United Fruit Company. So they gave his daughters two staterooms. So I assume, you know, I didn't talk a lot to my mom about this. The story was they left the port city of San Salvador, went through the Gulf of Mexico into the port at New Orleans, and then took a 2-week train from New Orleans to San Francisco. So quite a trip in those days. She was 14, so she was raised in San Francisco from that point on in the Bay Area. Trained as a bank teller in her early 20s, and the key story was probably told to me when I was 10 or 11, and can remember it making a huge impression on me. As most children, you take your family for granted, and my mom was my mom. She had an accent. That's something I never heard. It was just her voice. So she trained as a bank teller, Bank of America, and apparently there was an incident with a bank manager where she had asked him for the keys to the vault a few times. And the first time he dropped the keys on the floor, she assumed it was an accident. Second time, same thing. Third or fourth time, she knew something was going on, so she just asked him, "Why do you keep dropping the keys on the floor?" And he basically said, "I'm not going to risk touching the hands of a dirty spick." This was utterly shocking to me, and this must have been in the 1950s at this point in San Francisco. I think that that story, for me, really said, your mom is something different, and by association, you are something different, and you may need to be explained. And while looking at my face, you can't see what I am, and that's probably true for most people. That's been true most of my life, once people meet or hear my mother. In fact, even as a kid, there felt like there was a certain sense of deception going on. Like, kids would think I had somehow lied to them. And really, you're just living your life. Uh-huh. You're not going to flat out say to someone, by the way, my mom has an accent. You know, prepare yourself.
But in that era, you went out of your way not to be different.
True.
To be American, to assimilate.
Absolutely. That was the philosophy my mom came into this country with, my grandmother saying, you aren't American now. You have to adapt, speak English as well as you can, don't expect other people to. That was the philosophy. And I think my mom carried that philosophy with her too, which is why she certainly spoke Spanish all the time to her sisters and her family on the phone and in, you know, Sunday dinners. But she didn't speak it to me. She tried a couple of times and I would always answer in English. Whereas, you know, if she had pressed it, I could be fully bilingual at this point. But yeah, I think she just thought, you're an American, so that's what you need to. You need to learn English well.
My mother thought, we are just going to send the kids to Cuba for the summers.
And then
the economic blockade happened.
Right. And there's so many stories like that in the book, too, from other Cubans who think we always thought we would go back.
Yeah.
My parents always planned to.
Yeah.
Wow.
What the fuck is wrong with people? Really? I mean, what's wrong with people dropping the keys like that? What the fuck goes through people's minds?
It's staggering that he could have gotten away with that, and he did. And what was her recourse? Lose her job? Yeah.
That was the recourse.
Right.
Make
right.
a stand,
right.
and then, you know,
right.
not
and
be
she
able
wouldn't
to feed
have.
Your family.
Yeah. But it certainly stayed with her enough to pass it on to me. Yeah.
Your family is quite the melting pot in itself.
Yeah, yeah. Again, not knowing that as I was growing up, but my dad had two children from a previous marriage. He had married Tomiko in Japan when he was stationed there for the Korean conflict. And they had two children, my sister and a brother, and I grew up with both of them. And then my mom had two sons, my brother Ricardo, who's full Salvadorian, and my brother Henry, who's half Salvadorian and a mix of Scandinavian and things like that, too. So... yeah, we were a motley crew, and
Mochi and pupusas at the
same
table.
There you go. Absolutely, that's the way it was. Yeah,
that's fusion.
Yeah,
in the 60s.
Yeah, yeah, and we never thought of it. I think my dad definitely sought that out because he had been brought up in Jersey City, and was surrounded by ethnicities of all kinds: Italians, Puerto Ricans. You know, he told me that all the time, and I think he felt comfortable in that realm. So.
At the launch a few weeks ago, I mentioned that hearing Cuban accents to me is there's like a feeling of home when I hear that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when we got this place here in this neighborhood, we immediately started calling it Rainier Beach.
There you go.
Right? As the Cubans say, yeah. Miami Beach.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I saw a guide to Cuban pronunciations of different places in South Florida, and that wildlife area to the west of Miami is called Everglades.
Oh, I love it.
I do. I love
right,
it too.
Right, right.
So we call it Rainier Beach, and it's just a way of sort of planting our family flag here in the ground.
Right, right.
But the notion of accents as being familiar and pleasing is something that we grew up with.
Yeah, I think I've grown into that as I've gotten older. When I was younger, I was so surrounded by my mother's family, and her story, her life, was very central in our house. And, you know, we ended up having a rather fraught relationship, so I think more than anything, I blocked the language out as I was growing up, because it was so prevalent in our house. And my dad's family was on the East Coast, and so they were further away. But as I've gotten older, when I hear... you know, a Spanish accent on an older woman, I do kind of go, oh, I miss my nanny, I miss my mom. You know, you miss them anyway. Even with all the drama, you just miss so many things. Yeah, and hearing that cadence brings that back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.